within a framework. Fearless, futuristic and fun. Six F-words of coaching.
Nice. Well, that's a good way to start.
Good start, isn't it?
That's yes, cool. So Rusty and Fletch here with Brian Ashton. Brian's asked that we have a lot of structure to this interview. He likes structure. First question, how have we ended up with your table in your kitchen in Cologne?
Well, I suppose you've just sort of pushed your way in, didn't you? Like, when I saw you, I think when you were playing in this Bath game, wasn't it? And sort of talked about doing some sort of podcast with the work that you were doing. We're down here, it's our bolt hole from the north of England to be close to grandkids. And it's a place we used to live from 2003, I think it was, to 2008. So,
The rest is history.
It is.
and I'm excited. I know Fletch is even more excited because you would have been a big influence, well, on me, but possibly more so on Fletch. And what are you thinking, Fletch, sitting in Brian's kitchen? Yeah. Did you ever think you would come to this?
Yeah, pretty excited. I don't mean to embarrass you, but yeah, definitely. And I wouldn't be the only one. My generation of coaches would have been heavily influenced by Brian in terms of the work that he was doing around the National Academy and in the academies, and then when he went on to England, would definitely have made me think differently about coaching, made me think differently about the game. So that was exciting for me.
How's it made you think differently?
How does it make me feel think differently? Just that there's... just to empower people. So what I really liked about his sessions were the empowerment of the player, anything's possible type stuff. It's just, you know, just hasn't been done yet for possibly some of it. I like how you both challenged and supported players. So lots of players would have been, you know, they would have thought they were doing the karaoke. They would have been on edge, but it would have been a safe place. Would have been a place.
Just to explain the karaoke. So often at the end of a presentation, I might suggest, and bizarrely, it was bizarre today. So I'll say, look, I'm born on the 8th of April. If anyone else is born in April, then we're going to sing karaoke. We're going to sing. Someone's going to be Elton John. I'm going to be Kiki D. And just to get that feeling of nervousness about the session today, there was two people with the same birthday as me. You're just talking about Matt Banahan, so a session you did with the National Academy and Danny Cipriani, and do you want to talk about what those sessions used to look like?
Yeah, I mean, as Fletcher sort of intimated, they were deliberately made very challenging. We wanted to take them out of the comfort zone of what they were doing either at the school or at the clubs, because the age group was 16 to 19. I think Danny was the youngest one, he was actually 15 at the time, and I'm pretty sure that someone like Tom Rees, James Haskell, with 19-year-olds up at the top end. So it's quite an age range and a sort of from a mental approach to the game too. They sort of looked at the game quite differently, A, depending on the background where they come from, B, depending on the positions they played, and C, depending on whether they were still at school or they've been swallowed up by a club. Because it was still relatively early days of professionalism then. We're only talking 7 years into professionalism. I'm not all that convinced that English rugby got its head round it by that stage. So we deliberately sort of went out of our way, I went out of my way, to make sure that the sessions were really challenging, but actually also very purposeful. You know, it wasn't challenge for challenge's sake, it was challenge to try and improve these guys. And we had a sort of a fearless approach, where you could try, nothing is impossible, as Fletch said, but actually if you made a mistake, it didn't matter. It wasn't a game, it was a practice, and we're trying to find out what we could do, what we couldn't do, how far could we push players. Never ever believed, I think from that time, I completely dismissed the word potential from my vocabulary, because how the hell do you measure potential? And some of these guys were doing things that I thought, Jesus, where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know, and all you need to do is just give them the opportunity. And I remember an early headmaster of mine when I was teaching saying, look, you give kids opportunities and they will constantly surprise you.
And you were letting forwards kick, Brian. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, well, the thing that you were alluded to with Matt Banahan before was the session actually being run by John Callard, and it was a kicking to score session, and they could kick the ball in any direction they wanted. So I suppose from that point of view, the resemblance was more to Gaelic football rather than, and Aussie rules rather than rugby, but to kick to score at some point, then obviously you've got to go towards the try line. And we had the national media been invited for the day, I remember distinctly Matt Banham putting in two or three kicks. One was a crossfield, one was a little slip through on the floor, one was a chip over the top for other players to run onto and score. And the media just could not believe they heard this guy, who was then the second row forward, London Irish, was able to do this. And, you know, we were pretty blasé. Yeah. These guys do this all the time.
It would be cool if they did.
Sorry?
It would be cool if they did, because they can.
Absolutely. Well, they can do it, and why shouldn't they do it? And I actually remember not, I'm saying not that long ago, it is a while ago now, and I don't know whether one bounced off the other in the same game, but New Zealand played South Africa, and John Schmidt, the hooker, put a kick through on the floor for a South African to score, and I think in the second half of the same game, Richard McCaw did the same thing. So they were the two skippers, so it's obviously a personal battle. Yeah. If you can do it, I can do it as well. But, I mean, how often do you see that now?
Well, and what are you getting excited about in the modern game? Which kind of teams, which players, who are you noticing?
Well, I suppose you can't fail to be excited by the way the All Blacks have played over the last few years. I think, you know, they've got some amazing players, they've got an amazing organisation, the players are very, very well managed and cared for in the way that they're centrally contracted. But I think they've got what I call this, they play with an opportunistic mindset. Give us a ball, we'll score tries. And I think they follow the adage of, we're going to attack you when we've got the ball, doesn't matter where we are on the pitch, doesn't matter what the conditions are like, we never look at the scoreboard, we don't look at the time on the clock. We'll attack when we've got the ball, and actually, when you've got the ball, we'll attack you and still score tries. So I think they look upon, whenever the ball's on the field, they look at an opportunity to score a try. We attack with the ball, attack without it.
What do you think everybody's opportunities are? So we're in the running to the World Cup. Do you think anybody can stretch them?
Well, I think certainly the last two or three weeks, South Africa have been pretty close, haven't they? In fact, they won one game, and they were pretty close up to the 80th, pretty close to the 80th minute last Saturday. And they're in the same pool, aren't they? Those two.
That's a good question.
I'm pretty sure that they are. So that could be the final. Wow. You could see that being the final, yeah. South Africa knew on current form. But I mean, yeah. I mean, Ireland are a side up there, number two in the world at the moment. But I just wonder whether they've got that extra gear to go to that might be needed to win a World Cup. I'm talking about a mindset gear now. I think they've got players who are very skillful, players who will be in exceptionally good physical condition because they'll be very, very, very well managed by the IRFU. But I'm not convinced at the moment. I think they've got the players to do it, but I'm not convinced they've been let off the leash often enough to try and do things differently that really push the players into areas that they think, wow, I didn't realise I could actually manage to do this.
Okay. Go on.
I was going to say, I mean, we were talking a second ago about Wayne Smith and his comment about the 2015 World Cup. And
yeah.
When you talk about mindset shift, well, that's their mindset is completely different to everyone else's.
Well, it seems to be, certainly. I mean, and certainly, I've just put a bit of background to this. I've worked with the International Rugby Academy in New Zealand since 2009, I think was the first year. And so I've been very, very fortunate to work alongside some All Blacks coaches and a lot of ex-All Blacks players that they bring in for a couple of days to do specific positional work with individual players, which was fantastic for young New Zealanders to get these superstars saying, right, I'm looking after you for 2 days now, which is one-on-one. Fantastic. What was the question?
Well, it was really about, someone said, what are our goals for this year?
Oh, right, 2015. For 2015 World Cup, yeah, sat in Argentina having a beer and chatting about it. What are our goals for the 2015 World Cup? And the retort came back, well, we'll just increase the gap between... No, actually, it wasn't nothing to do with the 2015 World Cup. The question was, what is your main goal for this year? And everybody was expecting the answer to win the World Cup. And the retort came back to increase the gap between us and the rest of the world. And then the question went, well, what about the World Cup? But if we do that, we'll win the World Cup anyway.
Yeah, well, that's a cool mindset.
Yeah, that's a good mindset. I'm not surprised. I mean, I work with a chap called Paul McKinnon, who was a Kiwi guy who worked in the academies, and yeah, lots of the information that he would share with me around the differences between Northern and Southern Hemisphere, New Zealand and England would be a lot around the mindset. You know, I can remember him saying once to me, that we just believe that it will come good eventually. So often in the Northern Hemisphere, if it doesn't start or work well, certainly the first couple of times you tend to change you, mm-hmm. as in their mentality, and that's what he shared with me, was that we just back ourselves and eventually it will be good enough, mm-hmm. it will come good. I just want to take you back a little bit. Who were the biggest influences on your coaching? So we'll talk a little bit how you've influenced me. Who's the influences on you?
Yeah, well, the big one, right, in the early... I actually met him when I was playing in France in the late 1970s, and then he was... I went to play in Italy, and he was technical director of Italian Rugby Federation for 3 or 4 years. That was Pierre Vilpre. He was a revolution in the playing days. I think he was the first genuine counter-attacking fullback that the world had seen. JPR Williams claims to be that, but I think Vilpre probably played 5 years before him. You know, people are saying, well, you've no right to run the ball back, because in those days, there was, I don't think the, what they call it, you could just kick the ball directly into touchline on the field. And suddenly he started running the ball back, and everybody was, well, you're not allowed to do that. And so he was a revolutionary player. School teaching background, so good educational base in terms of creating learning environments. And took the combination of those two, the sort of pioneering player, good educational principles in terms of learning, into his coaching, and became a pioneering coach. And I think it was 1980-81 he started the coaching revolution at Stade Toulouse, and they were dominant in European rugby, both French club rugby and then European club rugby when the European Championship started. I think they won, I don't know how many European titles they won in the first few years. But he started that with Skrelat as his captain, then Skrelat took over from him. But the thing that struck me about Vilpre that was totally different from anything I'd come across before, that every single session that he ran had elements of problem-solving decision-making in it, and it was largely games-based. And I remember asking him the question, I said, what about the technical stuff? He said, players will find a technique to fit into the way we play.
I thought, wow,
that's an interesting comment. So for the last 15 years, I've been wasting my time doing all these technical drills. And when I look back, I thought, gee, he's right. They had no relevance whatsoever to what went on in a game. Yeah. And he's absolutely right. And it was absolutely fascinating. I was very, very lucky to be involved. Because I got quite friendly with him when I was coaching in Italy and he was technical director. And I got invited for 2 summers. 6 weeks each summer to go out and spend time with them, with Stade Toulouse, and watching him coach. And it was just so revolutionary for me. But actually, when I so reflect on it now, I'm thinking, well, why should it have been? Because it was a bit like my formative years of playing street games.
Yeah.
It's like playing in the street. It really was. It was, you know, and I like to think now that my coaching philosophy... Not that I do a lot of hands-on coaching these days. My coaching philosophy is probably loosely based on the street games approach.
Do you want to expand on that, such as, or what sort of stuff would be in there?
Well, you know, when you mention street games, immediately there's quite a few words spring to mind. I mean, we could come up with loads around the table. So I'll come up with sort of creative.
Should we do it in order? Should we go in order? Well, what comes to your mind?
Just throw words.
Jump us for goalposts.
What comes to my mind... creativity would be the first one.
Innovation,
probably.
Yeah.
Even in upsides.
Fairness, yeah, there would be an element of competitive fairness.
Competition was fierce, I found, in street games, yeah.
Obstacles, used to play around a wall.
Absolutely.
Fun, I should have said it.
By fun, what?
Fun, the whole thing's underpinned by fun, isn't it? Yeah.
Go on, anyway.
Yeah, discipline was another one, because, you know, if you started messing people around, the guy brought the ball out and say, I'm off.
Yeah, I'm off.
End the game.
Yeah.
Or take the wickets up and off. And that more than once in my environment.
Yeah.
I'm going now. I'm enjoying this. Oh, ball disappeared, wickets went, no game. But the key thing to me was, and actually we're pretty good at self-organising, you know, we organise teams to balance up. So let there were 7 players, and let's say you had 3 lads who were 10 and 4 or 5 who were 8, then you balance it up so it was equal.
Can I ask you a question, just because, I mean, looking, there's been a bit of stuff around it today, but there's been some 90 points to 10, 80 points to something results, under 12, under 13 games on Twitter.
It's pointless.
It's just pointless.
Absolutely pointless, yeah.
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 It wouldn't happen in the street games. Well,
no.
The ball and stumps would have gone home.
Yeah. Well, it would, yeah. It just wouldn't happen because we'd stop the game. We'd say, if the team was there, we'd say, well, let's stop, let's reorganise the teams, get a better balance to it. But I was going to go on to say that for me, looking back, the key thing was there were no adults there. It was about kids self-managing the environment. And, you know, the one thing...
Don't say that, Brian, we coach
well,
you.
Absolutely. Well, I'm just going to say, the one thing, looking back now, from my point of view, the good news was there were no coaches. So there's nobody there to interfere with my performance.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's good with thinking about it. So, other than Veal... actually, on Veal Presser, how much did he... So, say you were coaching next week, or you were last time you coached, how much would Veal Press still be part of?
Quite a lot, yeah.
Quite a lot.
Yeah, because I moved away from the technical stuff more to problem solving, decision making. And then I actually came down to the West Country where we sat now and got involved with Bath Rugby and, you know, with a group of players that they had there then in the late 80s, running right the way through to 96. These were guys who were right on top of the game, were very knowledgeable about the game, and to actually waste time doing technical work with them, I found out fairly early on, was something that they didn't enjoy. There's a certain Mr. Gustos. I remember turning on round one night, and I can't repeat exactly what he said because it won't go out on a podcast, but it was words to the effect, if that's the best you can do after 2 days' preparation, I could have done it on 3 minutes on the back of a fag packet, so something off. And he walked off.
And he would have had the fag packet, to be fair to him.
And he walked off and left me stood there with 22 international players.
Who would have... Back then, I'm curious, because I would know a lot of those players. Yes. Which of those players would have found it hard? So I get that people like Jerry and Catty and Stuart Barnes would like that. Were there players that you struggled with and you had to... think differently about? So how did someone like Nigel Redmond find it?
No, they're fine.
Yeah. Oh, damn, I thought Nigel was going to
Great. They were always up for a challenge. They almost demanded a challenge. They were sort of the Manchester United in that late 80s, early 90s. They were never, ever satisfied with what they achieved. And that's why in consecutive years they continued to win the league title. We want to be different. We want to do something different. We want to be challenged. And if we're not challenged, we'll let you know. You know, it was the best coaching award course I ever went on. It lasted 8 years.
Because I was going to ask you, which players influenced you? Because clearly Vilpra and people, you know, other coaches influenced you. There must have been some players at Bath.
A lot of players at Bath influenced me. Yeah. They suddenly... I realised... I think one of the things I really realised with the Bath players was actually, if you've got players now who've got knowledge in areas of the game that have more knowledge, in areas of the game that you have, then you're absolutely foolish not to use them. So you need to engage these guys, engage them in the right way. And actually, sort of set a situation, set a problem, and let them solve it. You've got an answer in your head, but, you know, more often than not, these guys will come up with a better solution than I had, because I'm stood out of the game, they're right in the heart of the game, so they see the problems, issues in a different way to me. And I grew up a hell of a lot as a coach, because prior to that, I'm not sure I would have been courageous enough to put myself into that situation where there was an alternative view to mine.
Yeah.
And then go with the alternative view. But actually, I learned that you didn't lose any esteem with these guys if you did that. And it was just the best way of engaging
them. You've triggered me on two questions. One is, what's been your best mistakes? So even I'm excited that Brian Ashton did 15 years of drills when no videos existed, so that was lucky for you. So what's been the stuff where you've your big learning moments? And then I was also curious about, have you been in other environments, because clearly you work in lots of environments now, where you see that relationship where it's the players challenging the coach? Because I love that. I think that's, if we're going to move the game on and get to this, you know, keep iterating it and making it even better, then we need a situation where that occurs.
I think I've probably partly answered the first one, and you mentioned it as well. For the first 15 years, so I was brought up under street games. And my formative years, from the age 1950, I was 4 years old, to 60, I was 14. Call them the formative years. So 14 to 24, call them adolescent years. You talk to my wife, who sat next door, she'd probably say, "Well, what adolescent years is still there?" Still in the
You're still a kid.
72, still in the adolescent years. But the adolescent years were the 60s, so that was probably one of the most rebellious decades of the 20th century, So you put those two together, the street games and the rebellious yeah. years, you think, as a coach, I will be all singing, all dancing, we'll do this different. And actually, I was totally the opposite.
Why?
I was a real command control, but I think just the fear of being a new coach, I needed to feel as I was in charge. I think, secondly, I felt all coaches have an ego. And I think I had quite a big ego.
Oh, Ryan.
Yeah.
Now we're pinning the layers
yeah,
back.
I got the tracksuit, got a badge on it, I got the clipboard, I've got the whistle round my neck, which is all powerful, isn't it, for a coach?
Yeah.
Blow the whistle, everybody stops and listens. I was a fantastic interfering coach. Interfere with lots of people.
Did you have purple tracksuit? Did you have the purple tracksuit?
Oh, I didn't have the love for one. I need RFU
purple. RFU purple.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, the old fluffy.
And then where have you seen this? So where have you seen a similar environment now where players are challenging coaches?
Not very often, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, a lot of the work I now, in fact, nearly all the work I now do is in football, and I've got a group of coaches. I've been doing it for 6 years now. It started off Premier League only, but it's now spread throughout the Football League as well. And I sort of mentor coaches who work from under 23 level downwards in the academies, largely lead coaches, at various age group levels. And I think there's been a big shift in the academy coaching in football from what I gather, what it was like previously. And now it's a very player-centred environment where players are encouraged, questions are asked, rather than instructions given to players. Specifically on players challenging, I think that's probably the next stage, to be honest. I've not seen that too often. That's a big mindset shift for a coach, that, to put himself in an environment where he allows players to challenge him, because inevitably at some point what will happen is what happened to me at Bath, a player will suddenly come up with a better idea than you.
Yeah.
And so what do you do about it if it's a group of 12-year-old kids? And they're actually like to come up with some cracking ideas because they ain't got all the baggage that other people carry. So you've got to be pretty certain of your ground, I think, and pretty certain of who you are as a coach.
Yeah.
To put yourself in a situation like that.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly makes sense of what's happening. Also, similar story within the rugby academies. I do think there's lots of environments that are empowering young people to actually challenge and ask questions and run things and do things on themselves. I'm still yet to see transfer that much into the senior environment. I'm probably out of it a bit, but I agree with you. I think there's an inevitability, but that is the next step, I think.
Well, you would hope so, yeah. I'd be interested. I mean, I've, like I said before, I've worked International Rugby Academy. I've worked alongside not any of the current All Blacks coaches, but certainly likes of Graham Henry, Wayne Smith, Mick Byrne, who's the kicking and skills coach, etc. And I suspect, but I don't know for certain, I suspect that there was an element of, players were fully engaged in that environment because, Graham Henry talked about halfway through the week passing over the environment to the players from Wednesday onwards, because Thursday was their big training day, and the coaches would just try and disrupt training on a Thursday by throwing crazy things in, and players would just have to find a way around it and then get back to the normal, whatever they were doing, etc.
Are you just thinking, why isn't that normal?
I am, to be honest. And again, I think it would be, in lots of environments, that would be different. I think, actually, often the start of the week would have a little bit more of that, and then by the end of the week, it's not necessarily completely run by the coach, but it's there's definitely a lot of order and structure and shape and certainty in the games. However, I'm sure it's going to change.
Yeah, but if you look at the game itself, I'm a great believer. I remember went a couple of times when I worked with England under Clive Woodward to the Marines, and then prior to the 2007 World Cup, we spent 3 days with the special boat services. They've adopted, and I think it's a 19th century commander that came out with it initially. I think it's about no plan survived its first contact with the enemy.
Yeah.
And the commanding officer of the special boat services could not get his head round this word, or if it's a word or two words, game plan. How the hell can you have a plan for something that's as volatile? Yeah, have you heard, you must have heard the phrase VUCA world, have you?
Yeah.
Volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. Well, that explains a game of sport, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah.
Because you're never quite sure what's going on from one second to the next.
So why do you think lots of coaches spend a lot of time trying to make order out of it? What's the purpose?
I think they don't like, I think they're afraid of chaos.
Okay.
And they're not quite sure. I'm not all. I mean, I don't know now. I'm speaking in the dark now. I can't imagine there ain't any coaching award courses that focus on creating order from chaos.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly. I do think it's pushing towards that. I mean, fair play to the community department for the coach development. I do think that is the direction of travel. That's ultimately where they're trying to get.
That's the plan, yeah.
That's the direction of travel. So yeah,
I think it's more informal now. There's more problem solving. There's more talking about higher order skills. So how can we create players that can solve problems? Yeah. How can we support them with that? I do think that community level stuff. There's been a big shift in that direction.
But I sort of got to the stage. I remember writing an article in the Independent. Entitled "Coaching Chaos is the New Order," which I thought was a clever play on words.
Yeah, that's a good play on words.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's this is the way we should be going.
Yeah,
because if you can actually get your sides to develop some sort of chaos that looks like chaos of the opposition on the field, but actually in the mind of your players, it's perfectly ordered chaos.
Yeah,
then you're going to get a fairly strong competitive advantage, I think. Out on the field.
You can watch a lot of teams and predict what's about to happen based upon. Right. So we were talking about turnover.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great opportunity. Lots of space and disorganised defence.
Well,
and, yeah.
I mean, I was watching a game on Saturday. I'm not going to mention any names at all, but there were two or three turnovers where the ball was immediately slowed down and the ball was box kicked back.
Yeah.
And you think,
that's game plan. That's game plan.
Yeah, well, why are you doing that though? You're just saying the opposition, yeah, guys, have another go.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Just bizarre.
So what's... Actually, I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your experiences with England. Or what was the... I mean, what were the best bits? What stuff would you have done slightly different? Actually, let's start on the best bits. What were your best bits while working for England?
Well, yeah, working with the side that won the 2003 World Cup. I mean, that was I was very, very fortunate, I think, coincided with a group of players, certainly a group of backs, who wanted to change the perception of how England played rugby. And, you know, you look back at some of the players, I know we were discussing them earlier, the two scrum halves, Dawson, Bracken, Wilkinson, Cat Greenwood, Tyndall, Robinson, Balshaw.
Tyndall with an asterisk, yeah.
Sorry?
Tyndall with an asterisk.
Yeah, he's a bit bigger than me, Tyndall, so Cohen, Luger, all those guys. And then Jason Robinson came on the scene, of course, halfway through that. And, you know, these guys all had special qualities, X factors in their own different ways. But actually, nearly all of them had a mindset, yeah, we'll take on the challenge of being different. We don't want to be seen to be playing like England teams played in the past.
And who was that driven by? Was that driven by you as the coaches, or was that driven by the players, or a bit of both?
I think it's a combination of both, I think. It certainly wasn't, I don't think... I mean, I can remember saying one Saturday morning before an international game, and sort of Clive had a wry smile on his face after I'd said it. And I said, you know, what would really, and you better edit this, what would really piss me off today is if you guys come off the field and you haven't shown the whole range of skills that you've got and done something that I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And walked off.
Yeah, stop it. Stop it, Brian.
Yeah.
That's pretty exciting. So when and
they would take that on board. I mean, deliberately they would. They say, right, we'll find something.
And what about the low numbers? What about the forwards?
Because we did a lot of work. I remember pre-99 World Cup, we had a camp tour out in Australia. We played the centenary test.
Mm-hmm.
We were out there for 4 weeks and did a lot of work with front five forwards on running lines and offloading tackles and things like that. And I think the England forwards became quite accomplished over that period of time in terms of, you know, expanding their range of skills. And I remember one game, I think it was against Wales at Twickenham about 2001, that Wales had been attacking in and around our 22, and they seemed to have gone through interminable phases, about 17, 18 phases, I think it was, when I looked back and saw it on the video afterwards. And one of their forwards got pinged for going over the top of the tattle. I've got a abiding memory of this. There was Jason Leonard and Simon Shaw fighting to get hold of the ball to take a tap quick at our 22.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure Jason tapped it to Simon Shaw and gave it to Phil Greening. And Phil, of course, was a forward. He was a back, really. Yeah, he was a back. And he took it up to the halfway line and I think we nearly scored from it. And I must admit, I looked at that and I thought, that's my job finished now.
Yeah.
Drops Mike Leaves. I mean, in the modern game, they might well all have run over to congratulate the guys that turned the ball over, as opposed to playing what's in front of them.
Yeah.
What was the difference between 2003, 2007? What were your thoughts around those experiences?
Well, for me, massive difference. Obviously, I didn't go to the 2003 World Cup for domestic reasons. Yeah. But in terms of the environment, so I think 2003, probably England had a good 7-8 players who've probably been strong contenders for playing in the World 15, so you could argue to some extent that maybe they didn't need that much support from a coaching point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the players that were there, there were a lot of leaders in the team, about 4 or 5 ex-captains of England, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So they could probably have done a fair bit of what they did on their own. But 2007, it's a much younger squad. I think England had gone through a slump from 2003 onwards, sort of falling off the edge of a cliff in many ways.
Why?
That's a good question, that. I mean, was there any forward planning?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah.
I think it means no.
Yeah, okay.
Difficult to say, because I wasn't actually there in 2003.
Right,
so
okay.
You can only guess, can't you?
Right.
But when a lot of the senior players went, then it just seemed there was no one there to replace them. And there was actually a gap, I think, between the guys who played. If you look at the side that played, the 20-odd players are involved in the match squad of 2003, I was thinking a good 80-85% of them came from the amateur game.
Right.
So these were people who'd had responsible jobs, who had to make time to train, to play international rugby, etc., etc. So they were pretty good at self-organising their lives. Self-organisation anyway is part and parcel of what they did. Some had good leadership roles in the jobs they'd been in before, so it was natural for them to take responsibility, etc., etc. You know, all the buzzwords you get now, ownership, responsibility, these guys just had it.
Yeah.
Whereas in 2007, you probably had quite a few players there who'd come straight from school into professional rugby. And I remember what Phil Vickery said to me at one stage, he said, "We've become too professionalised." And he meant, you know, there was too much coach domination, I think he was referring to. And he, you know, he's in a good place to comment on that, because he'd been in the amateur days as well as in the pro games. He said a lot of the stuff that we used to do has probably been taken away from us.
I'm assuming Sean Perry wasn't that professional, because Desa would have worked 2007. He probably wasn't that professional or self-organised.
It's a big shout out.
How did you find it? Because it's something interesting at the moment. Certainly in my role at the RFU, in looking at coach development, lots of coaches that are really comfortable being assistant coaches.
Yeah.
It's quite a big leap at the moment, given the nature of the premiership and owners, to become a head coach. You look at it in Wales, lots of really good assistant coaches, Stephen Jones, people like that, Matt Sherritt, Barry Maddox, people like that, but actually foreign head coaches.
Yeah.
How did you find that experience between being an assistant and then being a head coach?
Well, obviously, I mean, the head coach, you take on a hell of a lot of responsibility, because you're responsible for the whole organisation, whereas an assistant coach, you tend to be, although I don't agree with this, you tend to be probably just responsible for your own area. There's a massive increase in sort of weight on your shoulders, as it were. One of the things I found difficult was the fact that I never had a manager. I wanted a manager, I wasn't given a manager, so I had to take on some of the managerial duties as well. I don't like that, I'm no good at it, I've no interest in it.
So booking the buses, you were booking the buses.
Yeah, no, I wasn't quite booking the buses, no. But I mean,
What sort of things you told?
I can't remember now, to be honest, Fletch.
Well, is it things such as media and things such as commercials?
Yeah, and admin stuff and having to do commercial appearances and this, that and the other, and sit down and plan trips and this, that and the other, thinking, Jesus, I'm a coach.
Yeah.
I want to be out in the field with the players, etc. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't any good at that. I didn't enjoy doing it. The other thing was that, I think one thing that's really important when you head coach is if you've got a coaching support team that A, you want, and B, supports you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have that, if you don't get the team that you want, then it can make life pretty difficult for you.
It's tough.
It is difficult, yeah. You can spend more time then managing your coaching team than you can managing your playing side.
Just on that, if you could pick any coaching team, who would you be? Russell's an agitator. I don't think it's going to be you, mate.
I'm not going to be in the team.
Do you mean apart from you two?
Apart from us two, who would be in your coaching team?
Well, Pierre Ville. Do you mean from any time?
Any generation?
Yeah, Wayne Smith, Pierre Villepre.
Decent, that's decent.
That'd probably be it.
There's no one coaching defence.
Oh, wait a minute.
There's no one coaching defence in that team.
Yeah, for two or three years.
He wanted to be doing it.
You'd need a forwards coach, wouldn't you?
Who are you thinking?
Oh, Jesus, I don't know. I don't know much about forwards coaching.
Who would you pick?
Who would I pick as forwards coach?
Can't be Peter Walton.
Call me Peter Walton. I think young coach. I would go for Ian Peel. I've been fortunate enough to work with him. I think how he connects with players.
You're going for current one, are you?
I'd be similar with you. I didn't really hang out with forwards coaches very much. Go on, who are you thinking, forwards coach? Who was your best forwards coach?
The best one I ever worked. I'm not going to put my head on the block and say. I actually thought Nigel Redman was pretty good.
Yeah. Big Nigel.
Big Red.
Yeah, he was.
He's rocking it now, isn't he, in lots of sports?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, well, he's
world champion swimmer.
Coach, he's a British swimmer, isn't he? Yeah, he was Southwest Schools high board diving champion.
I didn't.
Was he? I've seen him swim in Wellington. He's terrible.
Well, I was coaching England Colts and took him out. We went on tour to Italy and we got this day off and we got invited to the villa with a pool.
Uh-huh.
And somebody said, "Hey, look at that." And there's Nigel. He's a big lad, even in those days. Yeah. Still on a diving board. He's at 1.5 somersault off the. It was about 5 metre board. Absolutely perfect entry.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
You can't imagine that. Just to get back to the... So, what were your feelings? Because, I mean, there were some players... I was at Newcastle at the time. There was a number of players who were involved with you during the 2007. Because, obviously, just to recall you... I mean, you got smashed in your first game.
Second, sorry.
And then you ended up... And then you ended up getting to the final with one decision from a touch judge.
Yeah.
You possibly could and should have won the game.
Yeah, you wouldn't have been sat here now because I'd have been served.
You would have been served.
We'd have to get the cash out.
Living in that castle down the road.
Yeah, so what were you, what sort of stuff was going on between those two games? Because I can remember the headlines, I can remember the game. And then to turn it around, what sort of stuff was happening?
Well, there were a number of things happened. Like Johnny Wilkinson got injured.
Yeah.
Before the first game,
yeah,
I think he was stood on by one of our forwards in training.
Of course he was.
Yeah. And then Ollie Barkley got injured in the week leading up to the South Africa game. So our two number 10s had gone.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to play. We played Cat and Farrell together at 10 and 12. And I said to them, I said, look, because Faz, I know it's different, but Faz had played fly half at Great Britain Rugby League.
Mm-hmm.
I said, just interchange, don't worry about... If we need a kicking game, then, you have Faz, you kick left-hand side of the field, left foot, Catty, you position yourself, send it, etc. I just left them to it. As it worked out, I think Catty played 10 and Faz played 12. But we didn't know until 24 hours before the game that this was going to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Vicker had been suspended by tripping somebody in the first game. So we sort of lost that sort of critical leadership. Mm-hmm. A couple of the critical players, Wilkinson and Vickery, from a leadership point of view, and the side was a bit disjointed anyway. And I think on the night, South Africa probably played by far their best game of the whole tournament.
Mm-hmm.
If we'd had a full side out and played out of our skins, we'd probably limited them to 20 points.
Right.
Yeah, they were absolutely outstanding. Everything they did turned to gold. And I can remember... because 2 or 3 seasons before that, when I was running the National Academy, I got invited over to South Africa by Heineken May, and I spent part of the pre-season coaching the Bulls. And of course, I think 7 or 8 of the starting 15 of South Africa were players that I'd coached 3 years before. And wow. I spent a lot of time with Fury de Pre, the scrum half, and he had a fantastic game that night. And I thought, Jesus. He's doing all the things we talked about.
I wish I hadn't coached him so well.
Well, I'm not saying that, but it was, yeah. So, yeah, there were quite a lot of things around that. And I made no secret of it. We had a meeting the day after, which was quite vocal, which was interesting. I didn't mind that because I've been involved in stuff like that at Bath before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bath, you know, the players were very. If anything ever went wrong on a Saturday, whether they won or lost on a Monday night when we first met, blimey, they weren't frightened of firing off ideas and thoughts, etc., etc. And this was just the same. Following day, I sat down with the key decision makers, 9, 10s and 12s.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said to them, I said, come on then, tell me how you want to play this. How do you want to do this? And we came up with a joint formula of the simplicity of how I wanted to do it. We'd actually done it before during the summer, but seemed to slip the minds of one or two of them. And then on the Monday following day, they said, well, are you going to present this to us? Well, I said, no, I'm not. You are. I said, you're the players. So I said, you present it, not me. It looked far more powerful coming from you.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, totally misinterpreted by some people, saying, well, you just abandoned it and given it to the players. I thought, well, I've given it to the players.
Because
funnily enough, they go out and play, mm-hmm. you know, and they've been part and parcel of coming up with these ideas. So,
mm-hmm.
And it just sort of mushroomed from there. And I think there was a bit of... We put a bit more simplicity into what we wanted to do, so that often gives you... If you get simplicity and clarity in what you want to do, you can play with more accuracy and at a greater pace, I've mm-hmm. always found. So I think that added a little bit to our game. And
what were your thoughts on the final?
I was a bit disappointed on the final. It wasn't a great game.
Yeah.
I think I'm not that convinced, to be honest, that there were a lot of our players who thought we'd win the game because we'd been thrashed 5 weeks before. But we'd just beaten Australia and France.
Yeah, no.
You know, and I thought, you know, I'm not superstitious, but I thought, oh no, South Africa, Jesus, what are these guys doing in the final? Mm-hmm. And actually, are they going to do three in a row, Australia, France and then us?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, mentally, we should be going in, you know, with the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I don't think we did.
Right.
When we get, I don't know if you remember the game much at all, but we kept... Montgomery couldn't miss.
Yeah.
Percy Montgomery on the night. He wasn't a great goal kicker, but on the night he was fantastic. Couldn't miss. We constantly gave away stupid penalties.
Yeah.
I mean, and they were schoolboy errors. Stupid, tripping people up when there was no threat to anything like that. Mm. Then, of course, there was that try that we should have scored.
Did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy that World Cup?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
When have you enjoyed coaching the most? Because you've obviously coached in loads of environments. I mean, you've done Fylde and you've done, you know, National Academy.
I'll tell you, very, very clear, not a million miles from where we sat, a school called King's School, Bruton, okay, played a whole term. They came to me, we had pre-season training 3 days before term started, and two or three of the elder players, you can hardly call them senior players, can you, at school? They're only 17 years old, came to me and said, they opened up by saying, we read last week that you're meant to be the most creative coach in the English game. you dread to think, gee, what is coming next? And we said, we've had a chat, and we said, we're on a challenge ourselves, we want to play the whole tour without kicking the ball. And I sort of looked at them and said, there's no way you can do that. I said, the game's not designed like that. I said, what if you've got a 5 metre scrum, the whole back division's lined out in the in-goal area? What are you going to do? We want to give it a go. Anyway, they persuaded me, and I said to them, yeah, 3 games, fine. Okay, we'll do 3 games, and then we'll review it. I thought they'll get stuffed in one of these 3 games. They won every game by 40 points, an average of 7 tries a game. And just played like that all term. I think they won 12 out of 13 games. And that to turn down an opportunity to win the 13th. They could have kicked a penalty with about 4 or 5 minutes to go right from the six, and they ran it, lost the ball.
Oh, wow.
And I thought in the changing room afterwards, because it was close to the end of the season, but really, and they weren't bothered at all, you know, because they stuck to the principles, and that was more important to them. But it actually made me, what it made me do was actually approach the game in a totally different way. I'd never coached like this before. It's almost like players challenging the coach, saying, right, come on, find a way to coach us to do this, and it was so interactive, it was fantastic. And these kids were 16, 17, 18 year olds, and not one of them went on to play any significant rugby. In fact, the captain of the team, who's anybody ever asked me who's the best captain you ever worked with, I said David Lemon.
Because David Lemon's outside. We've got him to come and see you tonight, Brian.
tonight
for one night only.
Like, yeah, because he farms not 20 miles away from here. He's a farmer in Wiltshire.
Right.
Yeah. And as far as I'm aware, story. I don't think he'd played much rugby when he left school. But he drove that team all the way through the term. His mindset.
Is there any stuff you wish you'd done, or you coaching opportunities, or players you wish you'd coached? Is there any stuff you look back and go, oh, would have loved a bit of that?
I wish I'd coached in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
I did some work with the Bulls, and I've done some work with the International Rugby Academy in New Zealand, down in New Zealand, and I've been to Argentina with them. But I wish I'd just spent a bit of time. I don't suppose the opportunities arose, you know, when I was, because I finished coaching effectively. Well, actually, yeah, no, when I was at an
in your pomp, age, when you were in your pomp.
Yeah, that's, I'd love to have gone and coach in New Zealand or South Africa.
And what would your advice be for coaches at the moment? I mean, you obviously work with a lot of them. And so if you're so players that are entering coaching and then just generally young coaches, you got any thoughts on?
Yeah, I think players entering coaching, just learn how to coach first. Well, I'm being serious, because coaching is not like playing. And the biggest trap people, and I fell into the same trap in many ways, is when you start coaching, and you coach in the way that you were coached. So actually what you're doing is flatlining the game. You're not taking it anywhere. You're just doing what you were doing 5 years ago. So the key thing is to think, A, do I really want to do this? And B, what does it mean? You know, because it's all about creating an environment in which people improve and learn, creating that learning environment. You know, and it's no surprise. Graham Henry was a school headmaster. I think Joe Schmidt was a school teacher. Veal Pro was a school teacher. I was a school teacher. And a lot of the top coaches around the world. Gatlin was a school teacher.
Lanny was
a school teacher, yeah. You know, a lot of the top coaches around the world.
And what would be your advice to young up-and-coming coaches? So, I mean, what's the advice you give?
Be fearless.
Are there some things you're giving to your young football coaches?
Be fearless. Six F words of coaching.
Here we go, gold. F. Can we try and guess them?
Well, you...
Go on.
Football.
No. No.
Fun.
Yeah, you've got to get them in the right order, though.
Oh.
All right, so think instead of game plan, we play with a...
Framework.
Right, that sets the scene.
Freedom.
Framework. So within a framework, you need freedom. You also need...
Feet. Fun.
Fun comes
Fear. Again. Fearless.
That comes later on.
Functions.
If you need freedom, if you freedom to play, you need a what of skills, of mindset. Because you might have to change the way you play, so you need to be...
Adaptable.
I'm thinking adaptability.
Adaptable.
Adaptable. But what's the same word as adapt? With the beginning of an F.
What's the second letter?
It's bloody flexible.
Flexible.
So you got your framework. So your framework, freedom, you need flexibility. You've got to be fearless.
Yeah.
Encourage coaches to be futuristic.
Yeah.
And underpinning everything's got to be fun. And I believe, again, you know, you watch the top sides in the world who regularly will play, and they seem to play as though they're enjoying it.
They're playing street games.
Yeah, we're loving this. This is fantastic. Yeah. Whereas other teams look, you know, you get that sort of what's now become the professional look on the faces. I know you can't see it on a podcast. Pretty stern thing. Geez, are these guys enjoying this or not?
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely be advice I'd give to some people when they phone up. Smile more. You definitely need to look as though you're having a bit more fun. Where do you think the game will be in 3 to 5 years' time?
Futuristic. What's it look like?
Wow.
Well, what are you thinking? When we sit here again in 5 years, what things will think we'll be talking
about? The global game.
Yeah. Do you mean it in terms of... In terms of a global game or the way it's being played?
Way it's being played.
Yeah, the way it's being played.
Yeah, I think the range... I don't think they've got anywhere near that. So the range of skills will continue to increase. I think the All Blacks, again, I know I'll keep going back to them, but why wouldn't you when they're so far detached, it seems, from the rest of the world? I think they probably... I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but they've probably got the conditioning right, that it's more decathlon-based than it is gym-based. You know, it's got everything in it that a decathlete needs to be successful. And they just seem to be able to run forever.
you know, the
good for Josh Hodge. Good for Josh Hodge. He does decathlon.
Yeah, he does. He's pretty good.
The number of games like last weekend when they won very, very close to the death. But I think there was a series of get. Well, there's that ridiculous last 2.5-3 minutes against Ireland, wasn't there, a few years ago,
yeah,
when they went through God knows how many phases and scored. And didn't they around that time too? I seem to remember that even though the games had been won, if they had the ball when the clock showed 80 minutes. They just kept playing. They never thought of kicking it off the field, and very often scored a try when the clock was on red.
Yeah, I've seen them do that a few times.
Yeah,
their sevens team do that a lot. They used to score a lot of tries.
Yeah, I think hopefully the coaching mindsets will become even more expansive and flexible.
Why do you say hopefully? You're not convinced.
No, I'm not.
I'm sceptical, yeah, if I'm honest.
I'm not. I still think, you know, a lot of coaches like to be in control of what goes on. And you can't, we talked earlier on about, it's a VUCA game, you can't be in control of everything that goes on in a game.
I mean, lots of coaches will write down to the lack of skill of players. So they would say the reason we're constrained, the reason we're actually cutting down their options is because they're not skillful.
What's your thoughts? What are you doing about that? You know, one of your jobs is to try and upskill them, isn't it?
Yeah.
I actually think, going back to the, if you look at the four, whatever you want to call them, the four elements of high-level performance and break them down into technical, tactical, physical and mental. Tactical, mental, you need help, I think. You definitely need help, so use the guy you call a coach as a resource, or whatever you want to call him, etc. You call him a coach if you like. I don't like the word, I much prefer a resource. But the technical and the physical, I think once you've been given the basic elements of a... I'm not sure of the basic elements of a technique, what you want to get out of a technique. So from a pass, for example, you want someone to pass the ball under control, but at a pretty good pace from A to B, accurately, flat, so it doesn't waste time in the air, etc. Now find a way to do it. And I think players should take a hell of a lot more responsibility of developing their skills and their physical side of the game. You know, whatever we call coaches, whether resources or not, there's a massive amount of stuff to be done on game understanding. A massive amount to be done on game understanding.
Such as? Give me some clues.
Well, I think just understand the dynamics of a game.
Okay.
And able to deal with changing situations. And I think the more coaching goes down that route, it's the sort of disruptive, almost hostile coaching environment, but in a positive way, to put obstacles in front of players that they've got to find a way around or over, and hopefully not blast straight through the middle, but like we normally do.
I actually fear for the game if it continues to be blasting straight through the middle. I actually think we'll eliminate a lot of people from the game.
Yeah.
They won't physically be able to cope with what's going on. And yet, you know, we chatted earlier about Dave McKenzie, Ben Smith, Conrad Smith, Aaron Smith, lots of people called Smith, who wouldn't, you know, would walk in here and you wouldn't recognise them as rugby players.
I said if they were in civvies, you would never guess that they were rugby players. And yet these guys play right at the top of the world, you know, for the best team and probably... arguably, best players in their positions. And well, McKenzie obviously is it, but you know, some people might argue that
he doesn't have a position. He's just freestyling.
He's just a rugby player. Yeah. And would somebody like McKenzie ever got a professional contract in this country, or would somebody point the finger out and say, "Well, he's too small"?
He would if he put another 10 kilos on.
Because he's, because actually, according to his programme, he's exactly the same size and weight as me. Same height, same.
Is he?
Yeah, so I could be playing fullback, fly.
You'd be better than McKenzie. You'd be better than McKenzie.
I'll be cleverer than McKenzie. Won't be quite as quick.
How would you coach it? How would you coach tactical awareness? What's the top tips from Brian Ashton on tactical awareness? Or in our language, beat the game. So
yeah, outcome based coaching. Yeah, find a concept that you want to get over to the players. Devise a game that has that concept in mind. Then either set a few rules to get the players, set a few rules, stand back and watch them play, let them play and start coaching from their interpretation of what you've asked them to do. And I think, you know, so one of the things worries me about coaching, especially if you're going with a preset plan, which is written down on paper, is actually it's you never coach or you never allow the unexpected to happen. You always know what's going to happen next, so you predetermine where the session's going to go.
Yeah.
So if you start with an outcome in mind, You're never quite sure where it's going to go, how it's going to get to that outcome. Let the players interpret it. If they interpret it in your way, then that's fantastic. If they interpret it in another way where they need your guidance, then there's the opportunity to step in. And instead of, I talked about an interfering coach before, instead of interfering with the session, you're actually enhancing the session. So you're an enhancing coach, not an interfering one. If actually they come up with a totally different way than you thought, but it's successful, you just say, fantastic, lads. Don't say, I've got another way. Yeah. Let's go with it. And then just build on that. But it's a hard way to coach. You know, you've got to have a knowledge of the game. I think all players should be students of the game. You know, if they want to get anywhere, I think all coaches should be professors of the game. So that they should understand the game. So you can actually stand on the touchline, watch players, almost as a spectator, watch players train, and then step in when you feel, if they ask you to step in, it'd be fantastic to create this sort of environment. Yeah. They feel, you know, please, can you help us? We can't get past this, help us with this. Or B, when you think, actually, just they keep repeating the same error over and over again, so now's an opportunity for me to step in and give them some guidance.
Enjoy that. That's a good way to end.
I could spend all night with Brian. Yeah. I think Helen would want us to stay. I think Brian, after the conversations around the trip to Lancaster.
Oh, it's our Emmerdale finish. I'm going to have to watch that again.
No, that's cool. But
thanks so much. That's been amazing. I've loved it.
Yeah, yeah. I could see you on
I've just met my heroes.
Do you think you're going to get back into coaching?
No.
If somebody phoned you up and said, Brian, we want you to come be our coaching consultant. We want you to come and...
Magic Academy, right up my street.
I'm 72 years old now. So
you're young 72. Yeah.
What are you going to do when you grow up?
I don't know. Why do I want to grow up?
Exactly.
I'm talking about adolescent phase. 1960. I went to rebellious decade and I took it to heart because in 1962, so I got expelled in the sixth form at Lancaster Royal Grammar School.
Did you?
Yeah.
And they've let you back to you now, you're King of Lancaster.
Well, I'm back in now. I was president of the old Lancastrians their centenary year, and last year I went up on the honours board at school.
Wow.
My mentor got expelled 3 years after me, and he's on as well. A guy called Kevin Roberts, who was world chief executive, Sergeant Sarchi.
Oh,
he was the guy that came up with the VUCA thing.
Oh, wow.
So, small world.
Yeah. Nice.
Thanks. Thank you.
Is that okay?
Awesome. My legend.